Into the Fold is a podcast on mental health issues produced by the Haug Foundation for Mental Health. The Haug Foundation is part of the Division of Diversity and Community Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin. The podcast is entirely funded by the Haug Foundation and produced by Haug Foundation staff. The views you are about to hear do not reflect those of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Hello and welcome to Into the Fold. I'm your host, Ike Evans, and today we are devoting our 100th episode to the movement for Black Lives.
How do Black people get to be human again? There's civil rights. There are all these rights we're fighting for. How do we get to be human again? What kind of world can we imagine where we get to I just want to be a human again. I want to participate in humanity and have the same rights as everyone else.
So you heard that right. This is our 100th episode. As a matter of fact, this episode is a celebration not only of our podcast, but of our many efforts to present voices and perspectives that situate our core concern, which is mental health and well-being, within the context of Black lives, and then to bring those lessons home to enrich our understanding of what mental health and well-being truly looks like. On May 25th, 2020, George Floyd, a 46-year-old Black man, was killed in Minneapolis, Minnesota, during an arrest for allegedly using a counterfeit bill. The background buzz that you're hearing is from one of the many, many protests that erupted in the wake of Floyd's murder in the weeks following. Calls to defund police have resounded on city streets and in city councils alike. Cops have been publicly shamed and denounced. Political leaders, university administrations, and would-be allies have been called to account. And perhaps most dramatically, statues are being toppled across the country. From one point of view, all of this looks and feels profoundly disruptive, even upsetting. But if you're at all like me, you also can't help but be impressed by the nerve and creativity of those demanding justice, and by the vehemence with which they insist on the legitimacy of their standpoint, as well as the soundness of the conclusions that they have reached about U.S. society and their place in it. Disruptive, yes. Impolite, perhaps. But no more than what you might expect from people who actually take to heart all of our platitudes about fairness and equality, apply those to their situation, and then act sensibly on the inescapable conclusion that follows, which is namely that the system is broken. To make one's pain, one's anger, one's most urgent thoughts on what democracy properly entails visible to a broken system, one must empty out their entire inventory of persuasive tactics. Polite or not, civil or not. Now, I could rant about this for another 15 minutes easily, or I could tag in someone who can get at the heart of it in far fewer words and with far greater eloquence. Deborah Deep Mouton is a mother, wife, educator, and the first Black Poet Laureate of Houston, Texas. She is a 7-time National Poetry Slam competitor and has been ranked the number 2 best female performance poet in the world. She was kind enough to share with us her deep poetic stylings befitting this occasion. Here's Deborah.
I have felt the weather changing, seeing the falling leaves painting the sidewalk in mosaic of autumn. As a transplanted Texan, these hoof-printed falls only remind me of one thing, and this year I heard the government is opening hunting season early. Now, every good hunter knows you need two things to be successful, a good dog and a good gun. Gotta have something to sniff and some way to shoot. It's important to get as close to your target as humanly possible. Make sure they can't see you clearly. This can be tricky. Hunting through the thicket and the cloak of night offer easy solutions. Now, there's no use in standing on top of an open hill, watching surrounding pastures and bushy banks if they're out of range. No, a better location is just inside the woods, so that if a buck approaches, you can move back and stalk through cover. Now, this can take years to perfect. I spotted one once, dark fur, oversized antlers. Say the ones whose pelt sags just below their waist have the most tender innards. This one looked injured, dipped when he walked, hand holding his private like somebody already took a shot at him. Looks under 35. That's good. Get them too old, they might have learned how to run, might have learned how to keep quiet and invisible. Except the most popular attractant is corn, but I've learned flashy jewelry, loud music do the trick. When a guaranteed kill, use some of that paper money. You can also purchase a call. One sounds like a mother's voice screaming out to Jesus. The other, the ringing of Sean's wedding bells. The last one sounds like a sweet young girl whispering, I love you. Anything that sounds familiar or offers false hope. Once you got them in your crosshairs, aim right under the hoodie, shoot and kill. Invite a friend, tell them we don't shoot to eat. We hunt for the fun of the sport. Let's see how many rounds we can put in him for his knees to buckle, for his family to come looking for him, you know. The younger it is we catch him, the more likely it is we'll make the news. Picture us standing next to his 145-pound trophied body like the catch of a lifetime. We could be legends like Irwin v. Crocodile, Fudd v. Duck, Police v. every black body. It's human nature that the more dominant species assert themselves over the one who poses the greatest threat. That's how we define a hero here in this thicket and this brush. They can try to camouflage themselves, but nothing that young, that black, that male will ever fit in. I followed one once for 19 blocks. Then my canine sniff out his blackberry scent. Didn't have my shotgun, so I just shot till my gun was empty. I wore his skin like a Halloween costume. They said the darker the hide, the sweeter the blood, and this year I heard the government is waiving fees for permits. So all you need is a rifle, a motive, a good hiding place. Try an alley next to a low-performing high school. Don't have one? Use your own front yard. Plant a hedge, stand in plain sight. Remember, if they come near you, it's only defending yourself. This is the circle of life. Somebody gotta be predator. Something, someone, always gotta pray.
That was Open Season, performed at the 2016 Texas Slam Festival. Speaking of artists, I would also like to give thanks to the exceptional artist responsible for the background music you are hearing throughout this episode. Odyssey is a rapper and record producer from Washington, D.C. The music you're hearing is from his 2016 mixtape, The Odd Tape. These sounds are coming to you courtesy of Mellow Music Group. You will find links to both of these artists' websites in the episode description. Racism and racial violence, especially when committed by authorities, causes trauma, even for those not directly affected. We know that for Black communities in the U.S., police violence is one of many social determinants of mental health. The pain and passion that we are seeing in protesters across the nation, including Texas, is rooted in deep historical and cultural trauma. Historical trauma is a topic that has come up on multiple occasions throughout the history of Into the Fold, and is one of the topics that I'm going to dive into with my panel of experts. Dr. Kristen Smith is Associate Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies and Anthropology, as well as director for the Center for Women's and Gender Studies at University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Ryan Sutton is director of the Heme and Sweat Center for Black Males at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously appeared on podcast episode 65, The Past Does Matter, a look at post-traumatic slave syndrome, as well as episode 34, Mental Health and the Black Student Athlete. Apologies for skipping over Dr. Smith. She previously appeared on podcast episode 56, Police Violence and Black Women's Health. And then our third guest is Latasha Taylor, a mental health organizer and a former Hawk Foundation policy fellow. She previously appeared on podcast episode 53, From Advocacy to Mobilization, The Role of the Marginalized. Kristen, Ryan, and Latasha, I'm delighted to have all three of you back. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, so my first question very simply is, how have you all been doing? How are you doing with all of this? And for the sake of this question, you're not allowed to say just, oh, fine, or okay, but something true and revealing about, because I've been roiled by all kinds of feelings, you know, going back to early June. And I would imagine it would be the same for the three of you.
I'll say for me, you know, kind of what you said, there's been a lot of mixed emotions because life still goes on. So I think the underlying emotion that I carry is exhausted, tired, right? Tired from what we're facing, tired from what we're seeing, tired from having to negotiate the pros and cons of life at this time. I recently brought my daughter into the world about a month ago, and I found myself even in that period trying to negotiate the joys of bringing a child into the world with the anger, the frustration, the sadness, the despair of what was going on in society. So still walking through life, managing, seeing these negative emotions, but then also trying to give myself permission to experience the positive ones that still happen in life as well. So tiresome.
I think that for me, my experience has been really similar. In addition to a just general sense of exhaustion, both kind of physical exhaustion and a mental kind of exhaustion, not only just from the protests that really started to be sparked around the killing or lynching of George Floyd, but even before that with the sheltering in place and the coronavirus crisis, it's just been, I think if there's one word that I could think of is overwhelmed. But I think that in addition to that, you know, I've also been feeling a sense of hope around the protests. I think that just seeing the words defund the police trending on Twitter was really inspiring in an interesting way, something I thought I would never see. And seeing in my hometown, Ryan and I were just talking about my hometown of Washington, D.C., seeing the Black Lives Matter chapter of D.C. paint defund the police in front of Mariel Bowser's Black Lives Matter was really inspiring. There's been so many inspiring moments, but it's also been really, really painful. And it's been painful to juggle specifically as a mother who takes care of two Black boys, who is really trying to keep some joy in the house amidst all of this complicated pain and suffering. I mean, the day that George Floyd was killed, or the day after, either the day of, I think it was the day of, was the day that my youngest son learned how to ride a bike with no training wheels. And so I think that to me, it really sums up how I've been feeling. It's this extreme pain and extreme joy all at the same time. And it's gut-wrenching.
I think for myself, this is just an echo. Just T-Y-D, Todd, just like that weight and that burden. It's just so heavy to carry. However, when everything was going down, particularly with George Floyd's death and the footage came out, I remember being on the phone talking to my mom, sort of in this like cocoon or in this space of my own, trying to make sense of everything. And I remember my mother being really upset. And then I said, I am confused because I'm afraid and scared, but this is the happiest day of my life because I never thought that critical mass would happen with this movement. Everyone, I just didn't think, you hope and you hope and you pray. And then I'm on the ground, you know, like marching and picketing. And sometimes it's like maybe 15 or 20 of us there. And then even your own community is looking at you like, you know, please, or, oh, there's the radical people. And then you're looking for people in policy to make changes. You're looking at the heroes in academia, and then you're looking for the rappers and the celebrities. And then it was like old-fashioned organizing on the ground that shook the world. So I said, wow, I don't know how to feel because I'm scared. And first I was sad, and then I got mad. And then I was just like, oh my gosh, this is really happening. This is critical mass. This is a point in history where, you know, that moment when nobody cares is what hurts the most is happening, and nobody seems to care or do anything. And now people care or are caring and saying something and doing something. That was gratifying for me. So I'm excited too now. I'm excited too.
Okay, so Latasha, you did mention the organizing that's taken place. So I'm just curious as to, you know, whether any of you have had the time, first of all, but also the wherewithal, you know, to take part in any of the protest actions that have been happening, or maybe you could just give me a sense of what you've been seeing in your own communities, you know, when you've been able to stick your heads outside of the door. And we can just go in the same order. So we can start with you, Ryan.
So as I said, I brought a baby girl into the world about a month ago. And one of the things I've been grappling with is how much I can be engaged during this COVID-19 time in the streets. You know, when I think about times when I was in college and times in undergrad before I had kids, run out there, be there, fully engaged. And now I'm like, well, now I have to think about these little ones and what I could bring back. And that's been a struggle in me, right? So I echo the excitement and the joy of what's been happening with the gatherings, with the critical masses pushing forward, but then struggling with, I haven't been there, right? And I know that's the responsible thing for me, raising three small children under four, one just got here. But seeing and engaging in the conversations that I have with my peers, working with the students to figure out what ways they're engaging in these protests, what ways they're engaging to push the needle, those type of things I have been engaged in. And I'm loving the fact that everybody's thinking in new, innovative ways in terms of how can I engage, how can I push forward, but still grappling with myself with not being there on the front line, despite the desire to want to be there.
Yeah, I mean, I think I totally understand where you're coming from, Ryan. I went out for the march that AJC did, Austin Justice Coalition did. And I went out primarily because it was driving me crazy not to go out. I always go out. I've been protesting since high school. And I've been organizing since high school. So when I see people in the streets, especially being someone who lives in Austin but not from Austin, and so literally watching TV and watching, you know, the space where I learned about organizing, DC, just become a space that was so energized, it was driving me crazy. So I had to go out, and I could, and I had the ability to go out primarily because, you know, I don't caretake really small children or elderly people at this moment. And so I was like, okay, I can go, so let me go. And I went, and I was really glad that I did because it helped with some of those emotions. I also try in the ways that I can to support organizers from afar, because a lot of the organizing that I support is not necessarily local. And so I've been supporting organizers from afar, whether that mean contributing to bailout funds or speaking to folk and help organizing folk or help amplifying people's work on social media. Also just kind of behind the scenes support. In addition, you know, we were, you know, helping young students figure out how to protest safely. There's a lot of roles that people play in moments like these. And I think that's, in listening to you, Ryan, I was really struck by the fact that one of the conversations that I was constantly having at the height of the protest a couple of weeks ago was talking to some of the people who couldn't go out and really reminding them that this work, I mean, everything that we're seeing right now is the fruit of multiple forms of organizing. It's not just being in the streets. If it was just being in the streets, then, you know, we'd all be in trouble, right? It's the, you know, as educators, the books that people are reading that bring them to the streets and help them to figure out what it is they're going to say when they get up there are books that I've been teaching and books that other people have been teaching. And I mean, so there's all these different roles. And so I feel like for me, have I gone to the streets? Yes. Not the days that things were really, really bad here in Austin. I did not go. But the day that Austin Justice Coalition organized, but I've also been kind of doing things to support the movement in the ways that I know it needs support that doesn't always get the kind of glamour that you see on the media.
You know, it was interesting. Usually when protesting and in the space of organizing is, it means to me just staying update and know what's going on. It means responding when you hear somebody not understanding an issue and reading. I don't like the idea that organizing or protesting is just in the space of showing up. I think that's the forefront, and I think that that's important. I mean, that energy and that your body being there in that space is important. But I tell other individuals, don't think that just because you're not there that there's nothing that you can't do. Money is still important. Donating and helping individuals bail out, not just going by hearsay, but listening to folks that come on television that are on the ground, like organizers and people who are in the forefront, finding out what defund the police means. Understand, you know, going to the Black Lives Matter website and reading where they're coming from. A lot of people will throw around terms of different things and have never even taken the time to go to the website or read the literature that people are, books that are being writing, articles that are being put out. So I think educating yourself and then just having that conversation, and any small, if it's $2 or $3 donating towards any type of cause. And also I think being a part of the conversation and joining any organization or something small, I think is organizing and protesting. I think when people were coming together, my concern was making sure that this was still Black led. I was concerned about that because I feel like when your skin's in it, no pun intended, but when your skin's in it, the decisions that you make, when to back off, when to move forward, when to calm down, those are things that I think Black folks are going to have to be in the driver's seat. Like if you look at all the organizations that are dealing with mass incarceration and police brutality, because it's all connected, it's interconnected. That's what's different about our civil rights movement now versus traditionally, is that, you know, the 94 crime bill came. Like now brothers and sisters are locked up. The police brutality is like the overseers at the forefront, holding up a system for a whole bunch of other people that don't even have to worry about it. And so now I see a lot of organizations and people coming up that mean well and they're allies, but I just want to see more Black leadership. I want to make sure that Black folks are at the center and at the forefront leading the protests in some way, shape, or form, because that's when it dies. Like all this momentum we picked up, I've seen it happen time and time again. When the people who are being hit the hardest and who this issue affects aren't at the center of it, then I find that it becomes watered down. It becomes a commercial showcase and other individuals will jump in and they mean well, because I think everybody should share the burden. That's what's important to me now with other people coming in and being a part of it, because it's not enough just to say, oh, so sad for you. I need you to share this burden. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, it's hard to think about and to talk about these issues if you are not Black. So for me on the ground, it's important. It was important to me because I saw Black people still at the forefront of it. And I'd like to continue to see that happen.
Yeah, so just to follow up on what you said regarding the commercialization, you know, one thought that I often have is, as nice as it is when, you know, a company decides that Aunt Jemima's time is past, you know, I guess it's better that they did that than not. But I worry that people get an impression that that's the essence of what it is that we're asking for, and that it all gets flattened out into that. And so, yeah, I share your concern on that, I think. So now that I'm kind of in this, let me ask another question, starting with this, you know, with the starting point of something that I've been experiencing lately, and that is that, you know, since all of this started, it's not uncommon for me to hear from well-wishing non-Black friends who are, you know, to be fair to them, genuinely curious about my well-being and so forth, which I do appreciate. But I mean, to put it maybe a little bit less kindly, I found myself in conversations where it seems that the subtext is, so I just noticed that you're Black, and there are some Black things going on right now. How are you feeling? And I hope that this is not too much of a leading question for you guys, but I can't be alone in feeling that that's its own kind of fatigue at times.
Well, I'll share a little bit, because I think that I've had parents at my kid's school who never started reaching out and wanted to do play dates randomly. And I think that, you know, part of what has been really difficult about that, and I hope that this is an opportune time to speak directly to those people who are not Black, who care and are trying to be kind, but it would be helpful for them to understand how that gets received. You know, at the height of everything with the protests, literally many times that checking in was really about them and not about me or my kids or my family. That was about them wanting me to comfort them at a time when they were starting to feel anxiety about everything that's going on. And it was masquerading as, oh, I'm worried about you. No, actually you're feeling uncomfortable and you want somebody to tell you everything's gonna be okay. And so you reached out to me just to make sure that you're not racist. And I think that is part of the reason why I have been careful to be kind, but also to not give my time to those people. And to be very deliberate about saying, you know, I really appreciate that you would like my attention right now, but I have things that are urgent to do in terms of the preservation of my life, my family's lives, and the lives of Black people everywhere. And so your feelings are gonna have to hold on for a minute. And I think that that's really tough for people. And I think it's really, really tough primarily because most people aren't aware that that's what they're doing. And most people would balk and become defensive if someone were to say that to them. But recognizing that I'm not talking about anybody in particular, I would like to share with those who are listening that that's exactly what's going on. It is rarely about comforting us. And it is mostly about their feelings of anxiety and the kind of habitual ways that the privilege of white supremacy affords people this idea that Black people are here to comfort them all the time, especially Black women. And so, you know, people want a hug from me and they want me to listen to their feelings and they want to cry around me. It's the same thing that happened when Trump got elected. The day after Trump got elected, Lord have mercy, literally my white colleagues were coming up to me and asking me for a hug. And it was about them and their need to be comforted. And the fact that, you know, and you mentioned Aunt Jemima, but she's really apropos right now because it's that mammy figure, right? This feeling of panic and then needing to lean on Blackness and particularly Black women to feel better. And I think that the best way to deal with that, if folk are really concerned, you know, reach out, say, hey, I just want to check on you. No need to call me back. No need to do anything. If you need anything, let me know. And some of my white friends did that. And I really deeply appreciated it. Others just straight brought food or brought something and dropped it off and asked no questions and asked for no time. And I appreciated that too. But I think that folk have to be real careful of wanting to feel useful and wanting to feel accepted and loved by simply reaching out and then wanting us to give them something in return. That wanting to give us something in return is not about us.
I agree with that. And I think there's a level to this that kind of infuriates me, because at some level, I think it's a minimization of what's going on. And you kind of minimize what's going on to be direct racism, right? We're talking about structural issues. We're talking about systematic issues that have been in part of this country for hundreds of years. And it gets minimized into this almost day-to-day microaggression kind of ways. Are you okay? I think it's a lot about comfort of them, as Christian said, but I think a lot of it also has to do with them remaining ignorant about the issues in this society. We've been obviously dealing with racism for hundreds of years in this society. People still want to act like this is new. People still want to act like, I did not know. I didn't know this was going on. I'm shocked. And I think there's a level of privilege in your ignorance to hold on to the fact that you don't have to know, that you don't want to know, that when time elapses, you can forget again, go about your life until the next shooting and say, I didn't know again. Instead of saying, okay, what do I need to do in order to use my privilege, in order to make a systematic structural change to the society that we're living in? And I think that a lot of this reaching out says, okay, this pacifies my need to be comforted. This pacifies me having to do anything. I could do that, pat myself on the back, and then go along with my life as normal, when that's not the case. And that's not the case for Black people in this country who can't afford just to have a conversation and then move on.
Yes. I feel like that moment when I'm in church and I'm like, preach, because I just needed to hear it. I just needed to hear somebody say that it is not my responsibility. It is not my obligation to make you feel better. It is my responsibility right now to take care of Black lives. We are dying across the board. And I am just not in a position to try to explain to any person that connection between how racism kills. When you're sitting if you're a white person and you're in a place in a space of privilege, and you're really upset, and I don't want to have to deal with this, it's like, you don't want to have to deal with this because you feel safe, but the police keeping you safe, watching television and saying, well, that defund the police, they're crazy, and not even want to have a conversation and understand what that means, that cops aren't rolling around your neighborhood every day, you don't have to deal with it. I think it's funny because a couple of my family members were talking about the incidents that happened in Central Park with the quote unquote Karen incident. I think that really was her name. And she was like, a brother can't even go bird watching. It was like, you know, trying to laugh at it and make light of it. But like, literally, you can't go bird watching. The one brother that played the violin, and they had a vigilance, is that the word, where violin players came out. And I think white people were shocked when those police came at them. They're like, well, wait a minute, we're the good guys. And I think that they're getting a taste of what we live with day in and day out. And I feel like it is not my obligation, it is not my responsibility to coddle you and to make you feel better. Right now I'm worried about Black lives. Sometimes the best thing you can do is allow somebody to be upset and angry. Sometimes the best thing you can do is to sit in your discomfort and finally, for a change, carry your part of the burden in what's happening in America, and let people be angry and let people be upset at what's going on and your part that you've played in it.
Yeah, and as far as trying to explain what's going on, I mean, it's not as if we haven't already exhausted our whole inventory of ways of explaining racism to people. The speeches we've made, the books that we've written, the classes that we have and will continue to teach. But it's, you know, it's there are only so many ways of saying what's true, considering the obstinate realities that we're up against. I feel like anyone who really knows me probably already knows what I think, and probably already has more than an inkling of what I'm going to say about what's going on. So maybe they don't need to ask me or find it in themselves to in fact do what they have an inkling needs to be done without my giving them permission to do that, you know? So it was George Floyd's murder that set this off, but we should not forget about, you know, Breonna Taylor in this. So it's so perfect, Ryan, you know, you just having brought a little girl into this world. And so really for this question, I would like to go back to the earlier episode that Dr. Smith was on. I want to quote something that she said so that all of us can discuss it. So we were talking at that time about Erica Garner, and to quote Dr. Smith, "I think it's important for us to recognize that even in sickness and in death, people are not able to really feel and empathize with Black women's pain." And Dr. Smith has had quite a bit to say, and very much to the benefit of our podcast, about how Black women experience, you know, the things that befall Black men, and not just in a vicarious kind of way, but in a direct kind of way. So with that quote in your minds, how do all of you react to that?
Can I just, since it was my quote, and there's something that just came up that was just immediate when you said that. Part of what motivated or spurred the protests right now with the lynching of George Floyd was the brutality with which he was killed. And I have heard over and over again that for many people, what put them over the edge was him calling out for his mother. And so I cannot help but remember his mother when I hear you repeat my words from the last podcast. Even in death, we are not allowed peace. There is a way that police killing is a public health issue that is so much bigger than we are even beginning to deal with. Because we're not just talking about the George Floyds who are getting killed much before their time, right? You can't be killed during your time, but killed brutally, publicly. But we're also talking about the trauma and the pain, the deadly disease producing, what I call sequela, that are eating us alive in the wake of these murders. And Black women are the ones that bear that burden disproportionately. No one talks about the Black women who are getting strokes and dying of heart attacks and dying of anemia and not able to function anymore because somebody has taken their child in that brutal, public, gut-wrenching, state-sponsored way. And I think that what I realized when we think about even Breonna Taylor, we can't even sleep. We can't even sleep. And we're not even safe when we're sleeping in our homes. And so, I just wrote a piece that hopefully will be published soon for an academic journal called The Black Scholar. And one of the things that I was thinking about was the impossible privacy of Black women and how police violence terrorizes us with that invasion of privacy. And I think that that is something that I hope that we all start to really take seriously. This is, when we think about Black women and Black mothers in particular, this is a public health crisis that is devastating us all. And we're, you know, COVID is a pandemic. Police violence is also a pandemic. And it is also going to have reverberating long-term health effects.
I was thinking that too, if I'm thinking about the role that Black women play. And then specifically for some reason, whenever I think of the intersection of the prison system, police brutality, which is just at the forefront of it, like just thinking about right now as we're sitting here, what's happening within the prison system that Black folks are subjected to day in and day out. And I was thinking of grandmothers and how the just little things that we don't think of grandmothers carrying all of the extra weight of little Black boys, little Black girls, grandchildren and their children day in and day out, and just holding all of that trauma. Because this is the thing about police brutality, is that it is terror. And the point of terrorizing somebody is to take away their agency and their ability to live full lives and have agency. So if you're afraid all the time, you're in a state of not living. It's like a slow strangulation. So you are constantly in a state of halfway living. And then I think someone would say, well, with George Floyd's incidents, what is the point and the purpose of the strangling? Why is that happening? And maybe if we could get more training, and it's like, no, they're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. It is a culture of violence that is supposed to terrorize Black people. And I think when Black women are terrorized, I think of holding Black women are holding Black little boys and Black little girls in their wombs. They're responsible to uphold the family structure. When someone is incarcerated, our whole family is incarcerated. So I think Black women are constantly living in a state of not breathing. Like having water and breathing are the essence of living. Like, we have life, but to live and to stay alive is to live in a space of safety. And I think if you're a Black woman, you are never safe. If you are living in a state of fear and have trauma all the time, you can't function. And then people wonder why do Black people have a hard time excelling in society? Why are the maternal mortality rate? Why are we always fighting one another? Why can't we just get it together? We are living in a state of fear and trauma impacted on top of impact. And then the Black woman who is at the center holding it all together is being clobbered as well.
You know, I want to piggyback off that, because when we talk about the Black culture, we're talking about a culture that the Black woman has been the glue to our families. The Black woman has been the backbone to the families in which we come from. And as was already stated before, they're caring for everybody. So even outside of the police shootings and the violence, the stress, the chronic stress that a Black woman will carry, even outside of these areas, is strong. Then you tax on the police shootings, you tax on the disproportionate expulsionary practices of Black little girls in schools, you tax on the healthcare system that has the highest rates of discriminating against Black women, then you just add to that chronic stress and chronic trauma. And the thing about chronic stress and chronic trauma is that it chronically releases things like cortisol, norepinephrine, catecholamine, these stress hormones into the system that shuts down the brain, that shuts down that body, that clogs up blood pathways at high risk. Because here's the thing, everybody has baseline functioning. And when you experience trauma and all these cortisol, norepinephrine, catecholamine get shot off, you kind of start skyrocketing. You can feel your heartbeat speed up. You can feel yourself getting tense. You can feel your hands squeezing up, all of this type of thing. And when the trauma subsides, you go back to baseline. But we live in a society, especially for Black women, who there is no subsiding of trauma, coupled with there is no outlet to process, and there's no outlet to take care of your mental health, because you're always caring for somebody else, right? You're always being strong for somebody else. So it's just adding on top of trauma over and over and over again, and completely literally changes not only the way you function, not only the actual structure of your brain, but if you're carrying small children, there's epigenetics. We know that through epigenetics, Black women are carrying this stress and carrying our sons and daughters, and that's being passed on to our children in utero, right? And it's changing the way that genes express themselves. So now we have little Black boys and little Black girls who are entering this world already exposed to a high level of chronic stress and chronic trauma because of that, which the Black woman was exposed to. So racism literally is killing us. The allostatic load that it's carrying on Black women is crazy. And then once you have all that breakdown in your body, you have to go to a health system that doesn't hear you. You have to turn around and go into a hospital and see a doctor and see a health system that has invalidated the experiences, the pain, everything that the Black woman has felt and has walked through. So you don't get heard, you don't get treated, you get misdiagnosed, you get underdiagnosed with certain things, and then that adds to the killing of our Black women.
Yeah, and we make Black mothering impossible, while at the same time, Black motherhood is always the most scrutinized.
Can I add something right there?
Sure,
I just want to share a personal story. I was outside yesterday with my three daughters and my wife. And we were doing sidewalk chalk and everything. And my wife turns to me and goes, every time you leave this house, I really get scared. I can't imagine what you have to go through. Right here in that statement, she was taking care of me. And right, and there was an area in there where I had to kind of turn around and be like, you're going through something too, right? And trying to give her permission to recognize that I'm in this struggle too, and that I have an experience in this struggle, because it was always going towards me. So, yeah.
Yeah. My last question. You're all involved in different things. And, you know, with the added caveat of the conversation that we've been having about people expecting you to perform your Blackness for their benefit, is, I guess, is one way of putting it. But if there's any one thing that any would-be allies, not necessarily involving you in it, could do that would make you happy, whether it's contributing to a particular effort, anything you would recommend that someone read, or just be keeping in mind, let's say, over the next month. So this is your opportunity to plug whatever might be near and dear to you.
I know for myself, I think of things that I've wanted to say out loud, and I felt like I was too radical or I was asking too much. And now I feel justified and validated to say that here locally in Travis County, they're trying to build a new women's jail. 90% of women can be diverted because they're going in there for substance use, mental health, and trauma. I feel like building things that are going to impact Black women, and as a result, children are going to be put in foster homes, like a women's jail. Things like the mental health unit that here, Harris County has the largest mental health unit, not for people who have chopped up somebody in a theater where people think a person with a mental health condition while they're being incarcerated, but they are Black people being incarcerated because they have a diagnosis, overwhelmingly Black men, just because they have a diagnosis and are experiencing homelessness, that 50% of the population here locally in Travis County that are experiencing homelessness are Black people, that I need somebody to do something and not hiding behind this idea that this is the way it is, that this is a fact. And it's not a fact, it's a problem to me, and it needs a solution. So my call to action are, these are things that I haven't even seen an organization step up and to the forefront, because it's too hot, it's too controversial. But I'm adamant about that. I don't care how much facts and data come out of UT and how much facts and data's come out of these prestigious organizations. I am not comfortable that you all want to build a new women's jail to address the mental health conditions and trauma that we've just discussed before, and substance use. I'm not comfortable with that. I'm not comfortable with the mental health units being predominantly incarcerating people of color, and that it's so large. I'm not happy with the idea that the medical model and the idea that if we just pump enough medicine into the situation, that that's gonna help all the things that we just talked about where trauma starts from. I'm not happy with the idea that once you change policy that you don't put in alternatives. It's my call to people is that the policies that you're passing, and then you're not providing alternatives. You know the trauma's happening. You know the things are happening to us, but y'all don't wanna come up off that money, and y'all don't want to come up off of programming and alternatives, and you don't want to listen to the people being impacted. Those are my three acts for that up until this moment. First I was sad and crying, and then I got mad, and now I'm excited. I want to see these brave, bold, new things being enacted. I want you to find a solution, find a way to make these changes and not just give lip service, and help carry this burden.
I think, one, I just want to agree with everything Latasha just said. And I think that we have got to really focus on what's going on in our spaces. I think that the first thing that we can do is educate ourselves. And I think that, does that look like, you know, actually looking up the books that outline what defunding the police means? Yes, please read those books. Like, if we just say, take a week and go and actually read Miriam Kaba, read Miriam Kaba's most recent op-ed for the New York Times, where she breaks down why defunding the police is necessarily an abolitionist platform. She's a long-term abolitionist. She's been able to articulate this for a long time. You know, read Angela Davis's Freedom is a Constant Struggle. Yeah, I mean, read Ruthie Gilmore's The Golden Gulag. Look at, you know, any kind of information or podcast or any kind of webinars. All these really heavy-hitting, brilliant Black women have been speaking, and you can consume that stuff for free on YouTube right now. It does not take a long time to actually figure out what these things mean and what the genealogy of these ideas is. So educating yourself is huge. But I think beyond just educating ourselves about the big issues, I really, really want to encourage everybody to sit down and learn, what is your local police budget? How much of the overall city budget goes to the police? How is that money allocated? How are services allocated? What are the needs in your immediate community? What are the things that you can do immediately in order to push back on that? I think one of the most inspiring things that I've seen the entire time was in LA. And when folk in LA, organizers in LA, were organizing to push back through city council on the LA police chief and try to get him fired, and they had a line of thousands of people waiting to call into the city council meeting and tell that man off. And yes, that seems like something really, really small. It is so powerful. And so if you're an ally and you don't know where to start, you figure out what are the immediate needs that Black people have in your community. Looking at all of the things that folk have been producing for quite some time to tell you what those needs are. And then you answer the call. We also need to defund the police here in Austin. Let's be real. So that needs to happen. Figure out what that means. Where can we allocate those funds? What are the things that need to happen in order to do that? If all of my allies would be willing to speak up for me when I wasn't there, that would be a lot.
I agree. The only thing I would add to that is start challenging your status quos. Start challenging what you have just taken as normal practice. Start challenging the systems that you benefit from. You have to start asking the questions about why things are, and it's not diagnosing those who have been oppressed. It's not criminalizing the behavior of those who've been oppressed. Understanding that we operate within a system that has very strong remnants of slavery still existing today within our culture that sets things up for just the way they are. But if you can start questioning and challenging the systems that you benefit from and asking those questions of the system, pushing those questions onto the system and challenging them, then you're using your voice for change. I would much rather you do that than just to call me and check on me. Save your breath for that. If you can start making those challenging statements, because that's going to make you feel uncomfortable. Once you start making statements that you realize you may lose some sense of power in what you're challenging, you might be on the right direction, and you have to get comfortable with that. So yes, educate yourself and advocate, and also utilize yourself in this work. That discomfort that you feel, use that to be a compass to where you're going, and not trying to avoid it, but leaning into it and then walking through it with follow through. So challenge and question the systems that which you benefit from.
I also wanted to add, Thea, Matt, I like the idea. I think Patrice Cullors spoke a lot about And a lot of her presentations about imagining, using your imagination to, if I'm a white person and someone said to me, you have to pick another race to be, and you know you wouldn't pick black. Imagine what a world would look like if you would pick black first. Imagine what a world would be like if things were not the way that they were. And I think defund the police and all the things that we're talking about here today starts with imagining, like settling down and that discomfort that you feel of there's enough to go around. There is enough for us to, it's not this utopic thinking that everyone always goes to. They're like, well, what are we gonna do without police? What are we gonna do without jails and prisons? There was a time when we did not have prisons and jails, and I call them slave patrols. That's all the police is to me. There was a time we didn't have that. This is something that has built up over the last 20 or 30 years. I'm trying to say, use your imagination and imagine a world that didn't have these things in it. And that's the most, I want to leave on something positive. Use your imagination and imagine a world where being black was not, how do black people get to be human again? There's civil rights. There are all these rights we're fighting for. How do we get to be human again? What kind of world can we imagine where we get to just, I just want to be a human again. I want to participate in humanity and have the same rights as everyone else. And I really charge people to use their imagination and imagine how things could be better. And then how do you start on the ground to build towards that?
No, I really appreciate that. I really appreciate all of you taking the time to come on our podcast. Ryan, this is your third go-around with us. Latasha and Christian, this is the second time, and it was just a real delight. Thank you so much for the rich dialogue and just for, you know, giving voice to what I think, you know, many of our folks are feeling right now. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having us and doing this and making this space. We appreciate all the work that you do.
And I'm happy. I feel good.
Yeah, I'm about to say,
thank you.
A therapeuticness to it.
Yes,
for
I'm.
Totally.
Yes.
Totally.
I had a sense it might get a little heavy, so I'm glad. But I'm glad that you're at least you're, if nothing else, you're feeling good. So.
Now, if I've come to appreciate anything from my time here at the Hogg Foundation, it is that a mind is a community project. This implies that there are times when there is entirely too much going on for one mind to make sense of. The upshot of this is that for anything that truly matters, there's always more to say. With that in mind, I want to give you a taste of what people are saying about the movement for Black Lives from my own community of Austin, Texas. The audio you're about to hear was provided courtesy of KUT.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Black Lives
Matter! You know, we're not promoting violence, you know, that's not the thing, but we're just trying to promote the power for black people. You know, we stand for our pride. You know, we're tired of getting killed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Been happening for years. It's just the fact that everybody has a cell phone to view it with a camera. You know, this has been happening for years. Yeah, it's about time for this. It's been well overdue. It's been over 400 years of oppression.
End of the Fold began in 2014. From day one, our goal has been to capture the human implications of mental health and the factors that influence it, bringing you conversations with mental health experts, consumers, advocates, practitioners, researchers, and community leaders from across Texas and beyond. Before signing off, I thought I'd leave you with a sampling of different voices belonging to guests who have appeared on the show over time, speaking about mental health and well-being. I'd also like to take this time to personally thank all of the guests who have appeared on the podcast, my colleagues at the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and the various collaborators and well-wishers who've supported this effort over the last 6 years. I couldn't have done this without you.
It's all of those root causes and those underlying issues that may be stemming from within a community that overall are going to create the health and happiness of that particular person and then the overall community as a whole.
For me, it's the person's ability to thrive. It's the person's ability to take care of themselves, to recognize that when they're having some challenges, being able to recognize that they can go out and seek support.
Having their basic needs met, as well as having community and connection and involvement and something that brings them joy.
I really believe in this concept of reverse mentoring, you know, what we can learn from younger people. And so just through constant conversations with them, it really helps me know where I should put my time and energy and how the vision and the university needs to meet the needs of students.
Listen to the community, because I think no one knows more about the community than the community. And so sometimes it's easy to forget that. And so we go in these communities with a game plan and we try to tell them like, hey, this is what we're going to do for you guys. And this is what this is what's best for you, instead of sometimes listening and, you know, what are your needs?
When you talk about the word transformation related to mental health, it really brings back to that old school, just building relationships, building trusting relationships with your neighbor, getting to know the people around you in your community and just making those everyday connections with them.
As always, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and Google Play Music. Thanks for joining us.